This is Ozarks at Large. There are many examples of how the politics of the mid-19th century developed. Slave-owning businessmen in the South and many of their business counterparts in the North discussed the future of slavery and what it meant for commerce. Members of both houses of Congress attempted to flex political influence. Abolitionists increased their activism. And African Americans, slaves, fugitive slaves, and those who were free also participated in the political landscape. In the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Nation Under Our Feet, Black Political Struggles in the Rural South from Slavery to the Great Migration, Steve Hahn examines African Americans' role in a national political dialogue from slavery through the Civil War, during Reconstruction, and beyond. He's the author of other books as well, including The Political Worlds of Slavery and Freedom. He delivered a Hartman Hotz lecture on the University of Arkansas campus last night titled, How About a Shorter Civil Rights Movement? Black Nationalism, Social Democracy, and the Limits of the Slavery to Freedom Narrative. Yesterday, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio before he delivered that lecture. I asked him how he managed to find enough historical information about African-American political influence during a time when many black people were denied basic rights and had limited ways to record their thoughts and records.
I was doing a seminar paper, and I was interested in the transition from slavery to freedom. And at that time, my main interest had to do with labor. I was interested in what happened when slavery collapsed and new forms of labor relations were constructed. And at that point, the records of the Freedmen's Bureau, which is the federal agency to oversee this transition, had just been microfilmed. So I was working on Mississippi, and the reason I chose Mississippi was they had about 6 reels of labor contracts. So I was going to read them. But each month, the bureau official on the ground had to file a report about what was going on, which were very, very interesting and revealing. And I remember at one point, I saw a report coming in that was expressing complaints from landowners, planters, that black men and women who were working on these plantations were leaving work on Saturdays and walking 25 miles to go to a political meeting.
One way.
One way. And in the face of a lot of intimidation. And at the time, this was quite a while ago, at the time, there was very little in the literature that would help me understand what happened, because by and large, the idea was that slavery had rendered African Americans pretty defensive, that their ability to construct politics was almost non-existent. After all, they were slaves and they weren't part of the political community in any official sense, and that eventually they fell under the thumbs of various groups of whites who were competing with each other to see who could manipulate them. And I remember reading this, and I wasn't sure what to make of it at the time, but I was stunned by this, because it seemed to me this was in very early 1868. It was very soon after the franchise was extended to African-American men. And it seemed to me there was, you know, this didn't come out of nowhere. That somehow or other, you know, they didn't learn this since 1865. I mean, this is something that obviously drew on their own interests, aspirations, practices, and so on. So on the one hand, it raised questions about slavery. I mean, was there a political story to slavery that we hadn't really explored? And it also raised questions about what happened after, because, you know, I was living in a world where you could hardly get anyone to go vote, you know, if it was raining out. You know, turnouts were so low. And I learned very quickly that about 90% of eligible black voters registered to vote, and very, very high proportions of those who were registered went out to vote, despite the fact that it was an extremely dangerous undertaking. So right from there, I thought, you know, this is a really interesting topic. I don't really know much about it. I ended up doing another project first, which was on small, humble white people. But I really wanted to get back to this. And when I did, I had enough experience. It seemed, what I thought I learned as a historian was that the key thing was the questions you asked. Because there were always ways of trying to get some answers if you asked interesting questions. It was a matter of how you looked at the documents. If you were simply interested in the documents, then you would have said, well, there's nothing on this subject because, after all, as slaves, they had no place in American political life. I also began to read literatures on rural peoples in other societies, and I was especially interested in a group of people who were scholars of South Asia. They were called the Subaltern Studies Group, and beginning in the late 70s, early 1980s, influenced by social historical work, but also trying to, you know, most of U.S. and European social history was focusing mostly on cities and the urban and industrial working class. But they were looking at South Asia, where the population was overwhelmingly rural and peasant, and was also colonial. Mm-hmm. And so people's access to official positions in political life were non-existent. So they began to look at a whole variety of ways in which people practiced politics, despite the fact that they didn't have a franchise. So I began to learn things about this. One of the things I got interested in were as forms of political discussion and rumors. I got interested in that because I started studying this insurrection scare in 1865, which was a question of what rumors began circulating all over the South that the federal government, as a Christmas present, was going to redistribute land to former slaves. And that was among African Americans. And among white Southerners, the rumor was that if the federal government didn't do this, that they were going to rise up in rebellion and do this themselves. So I remember when I was reading a lot of the documents, and the Freedmen's Bureau and other military records are really interesting about this, I was struggling with what to make sense out of it. And, you know, because the idea of rumor tends to have a negative connotation, that it's not really true, and it needs to be validated by various, more official sources. But because I was reading all over the place, I began to think that the question of what was true or not was something that was determined by how a story was told and who was telling it, and that rumor was a speech act like many other speech acts, and it was a form that of people making contact with each other and discussing politics under these sort of circumstances. And it began to open up a whole variety of ways of thinking about how people who were not part of the formal arenas of political life, nonetheless engaged in the practice of politics.
But there was communication. That's what's so interesting.
Communication is I think, as a subject, it's not been, it's studied much better by people actually outside of history than by historians. I mean, sociologists study this, anthropologists study this, people in the media and communication study it. I think it's key, obviously, any sort of political society, communication, especially if you're looking at people who are not easily to access, whose literacy, who are literate in ways that are not accessible to us. That's sort of a baseline. How do people communicate with each other? You know, when I would present my work to non-American audiences, part of their response was, well, of course. In a sense, if you think about equating politics and the franchise, that the history of politics in the world would be, pretty, pretty small. I mean, most of world history and most of our history, even to this day, involves people who don't have access to the franchise, but nonetheless, you wouldn't want to say that they have no political interest or don't practice politics in any meaningful way.
You begin the book, One Nation Under Our Feet, with an account of slaves discussing the election of 1860. And you use the term the Black Republican, capital B, capital R, referring to Abraham Lincoln. That's how he was known by?
Yeah, well, that's how he was known by their owners. The Black Republicans was an epithet that especially secessionists thought. You know, this is a really interesting moment because it's the 150th anniversary of secession, the beginning of the Civil War, Lincoln's election. And, it raises a lot of interesting questions about, there's so much literature. In fact, I'm just reviewing Eric Foner's new book on Lincoln and slavery. And there's another side to that story, and it's a question we don't really ask so much, is that, we're interested in what did Lincoln think about slaves, what did Lincoln think about slavery, but there's also the other question, what did slaves think about Lincoln, and what did they do or not do because of that? And that is one of the things that was opened up to me because of this sort of rumor and communication issue, is that I began finding evidence, in varieties of sources, mostly of white people who were worried about this, who said, you know, their slaves were talking about this, they knew about this, they had certain imagined ideas about what Lincoln's election represented, whether it was true or not. And I think one of the things that's really amazing about the Civil War period is it's one of these, I mean, usually subaltern lower classes get it wrong, and they pay a very heavy price. They imagine that there is someone on their side in a powerful position, and it enables them to mobilize rebellions or resistance or other forms of pushback. And usually they discover, unfortunately, that they got it wrong and they don't have an ally in a strong place and they get slaughtered. But the Civil War is one of these moments where they imagine a situation that actually does not exist, that they imagine that Lincoln and the Republican Party was an anti-slavery ally. They imagine that the Union was invading the South because their owners were part of it, was their owners were saying, these people are coming down here and they want to overturn this order, they want to set you free, and they want to divide up the plantations. And they thought this was a pretty good idea. So they assumed that Lincoln's, you know, the campaign for the election, Lincoln's election, his inauguration, they were thinking, you know, there was a political sophistication that was pretty amazing. I mean, I found a diary written by this guy who is named William Webb, who was a slave in Kentucky and Mississippi. And he kind of tells a story. He ends up in Detroit. And he tells a story of organizing as a slave. And he talks about the 1856 election when the Republicans for the first time ran a candidate, John C. Fremont. Okay, and they're running on their anti-slavery platform is non-extension of slavery, but they accept the idea that there's no constitutional authority over slavery in the states. And so he explains that they're talking about themselves, that Fremont's on their side, and if Fremont wins the election, they're going to be free. And in 1856, there's a lot of unrest all over the South. And then he loses. So this guy, William Webb, explains that they then get together and try to decide what to do. And he says some people, some of the slaves were talking about rebelling, and others said, wait 4 more years. Now, whether that's naive or not, they actually knew that there was a 4-year cycle to the presidential election, that they had an understanding of how American politics worked, and they certainly knew that, as Frederick Douglass once put it, an enemy of my enemies has got to be my friend. And so their ears were always perked up, as is often the case among people who are in subordinate positions, and they try to get as much information as possible. So I do think that one of the things that struck me is that most people who study what slaves do during the Civil War sort of begin with the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And there's no explanation of why they do what they do. After all, they could have done several things. They could have stayed put, which they did when John Brown invaded Harper's Ferry. We know that people, slaves in the area, knew all about this. But they might have thought that this was not such a good idea. They could have stayed put. They could have headed to the hills in some ways, like John Brown wanted. You know, you head to inaccessible locations. They could have done a lot of things, but they decided to head to the Union Army encampments. Presumably, it's because they had some idea of what the Union Army encampments represented and what they meant in political terms. So I guess part of my work is to suggest that if you really want to understand what's going on, you can't just start with the war, which makes them simply reactive. In other words, well, they're just going because they're going, not because they think something is going on. And we need to see some sort of relationship between what slaves do during the war, what slaves were thinking about before the war, fights they had among themselves, which they clearly did. I mean, this is dangerous business. You know, they knew that running off their plantations under any circumstances, you know, put their lives and the lives of their families and friends in a great deal of danger. And why did they decide to do that? How did they find out where the Union Army was? What sort of information? And then they began learning that not every Union Army commander let them in. Sometimes they sent them back to with their owners. This was kind of dangerous business and worrisome. So these kind of communication networks, it seems to me, were really interesting and provided insight into what was going on.
The one thing I take away more than anything else after reading the book, A Nation Under Our Feet, is the importance of participation. Mm-hmm. And not taking anybody's role for granted.
I think that's an interesting way of putting it, and I'm very happy that that's one of the things you took away. You know, we live in a world where people's sense of political engagement is, admittedly, it's erupting in new ways. And I think, you know, whatever you think of how it's erupting, I think overall it's a good thing.
And it'll be very interesting to historians perhaps 100 years from now.
Well, absolutely. And it'll be very interesting to see as we deal with the 150th anniversaries, how people see their own relationship to a past and how they construct the past. And we're going to see a lot of fighting about this. You know, I thought the issue of whether you could secede from the Union or not was kind of dead and buried, but apparently it's not. And all in all, it's probably a good thing. But in terms of participation, I think one of the, you know, the thing that moved me about it is to watch people who were in very difficult circumstances, had limited access to political resources, who had every reason to fear participation in political life and some attempt to take control over their lives and influence the world around them, and how they managed in the face of all of this to be activists nonetheless. And, you know, part of the story is that how they managed to drag along people who didn't want to be active. And I think part of the nasty side is that politics involves punishment and reprisals and ideas of betrayal. And these are aspects of African-American political life that, you know, or any political life, we don't really want to go into very much. But how else are you going to manage to protect yourselves and survive? There's always different ways of being active. And some of these involve guns, which is also uncomfortable, especially for white Americans who, you know, the image of a black man or woman with a gun is very terrifying. But armed self-defense is part of the story, too. So, I mean, I do think it also reminds us that what we value in our country and our democracy was contributed to in very powerful ways by all sorts of people, and that they are part of this kind of universe of rights making and rights creation and political activity. And I think we need to know that.
Steve Hahn, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Steve Hahn is the author of the Pulitzer Prize winning book, A Nation Under Our Feet: Black Political Struggles in the Rural South from Slavery to the Great Migration. Last night, he delivered a Hartman Hotz lecture on the University of Arkansas campus. The Hartman Hotz lecture series is sponsored by the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and the School of Law. You can hear more from our conversation at our website, OzarksAtLarge.com.